From the Borough Radio newsroom, Sikir Starmer has today said sorry over decades of forced adoptions in England and Wales. Around 185,000 children were taken from their unmarried mothers in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. A full report 4 years ago found governments then bore ultimate responsibility for causing pain and suffering. Campaigner Karen Constain says it's long overdue.
The reason it's vital is the ageing profile of the people that were impacted. And this wasn't 185,000 people. This is more like 500,000 people that were impacted by this heinous practice.
There have already been apologies from Welsh and Scottish ministers. A fire has broken out at the former Aberthorpe power station. CCR Energy commissioned specialist contractors to undertake the demolition of the site as it looks to redevelop it into a green energy and zero carbon innovation hub. South Wales Fire and Rescue Service has confirmed that they're on site. In a statement, they advised residents in the local area to keep their windows and doors closed due to large amounts of smoke. Meningitis B vaccinations are set to be offered to 17 and 18-year-olds in Cardiff and the Vale of Glamorgan from this July. Cardiff and Vale University Health Board will be sending out appointment letters to all those born between September 1st, 2007 and August 31st, 2008. The vaccination programme has been introduced in response to recent meningitis outbreaks, whilst a full review of the evidence by the Joint Committee on Vaccinations and Immunisation is underway. And a business run by an entrepreneur from Barry has been named a winner in the UK Startup Awards 2026. Little Child and Hayley was named the regional winner in the Professional Services Startup of the Year category. The firm will now represent Wales at the national final taking place at Ideas Fest in September. In sport, Barrytown United will kick off their 26-27 Cymru Premier campaign against Cambrian United at Jenner Park on the 31st of July. They'll then travel on the 7th of August to face Flint Town before welcoming Cardiff Met on the 14th of August. The FAW has released the Phase 1 fixtures for the expanded 16-team league with all four newly promoted clubs in action on the opening Friday night.
For more local news for the Vale of Glamorgan,
head to broradio.fm.
Welcome to History on Your Doorstep here on Bro Radio, the station that loves the Vale, and this is the programme that loves Vale history. In tonight's programme, we are bringing you a talk that I gave only a few weeks ago to the charming people of the village of Lalliston near Bridgend. Now, Lalliston, in particular the church in Lalliston, the Church of St David's, is celebrating its 800th year this year. And as part of the celebrations, I was invited to come and give a couple of talks on different topics, and this is one which I think might be quite a bit of fun for the regular listeners to this show. Now, I'll be up front with you. History might be stretching it a little bit, okay? Let's accept historical literature as being the subject of this talk, because it's all about King Arthur and his connection with the Dark Age Welsh saints. Now, as you know, that's something of a topic I am extraordinarily fascinated by. And King Arthur is one of these characters that has just survived for over, well, if we believe everything we're told, 1,500 years, roughly, is still in the ether. They're still making films and programmes about him today. He's one of the enduring superheroes from historical literature. And you may think you know who he is. You may think you know all there is to know about Arthur. But if you haven't heard the version of him that is in the accounts of the saints from Wales who lived at his time, then I'm about to introduce you to a completely new character, one that you have never come across before, not the dashing, chivalrous hero of the stories that we hear from other sources. No, this chap is altogether more dark and sinister. I don't want to give too much away. I'm going to shut up now and let me do the talking, which may sound odd, but I know what I mean. Over to me in Lalliston.
Thank you. I'm Diolch yn fawr, and thank you very much for having me along today. Funnily enough, I get asked to do a lot of television programmes about Arthur. Let me be absolutely honest with you, he's not a specialist area. But as long as the work keeps coming, I will keep doing it. So, my specialist area is medieval monastic Wales. That's my specialist area. And last time I was here, I gave you a sort of summary view of all of that. And that's where all the Arthur stories originate from. I mean, they grew arms and legs subsequently, but that's definitely where they came from. It says, who is Arthur? I'm going to skim answer that question because it's not as straightforward as you might think. But I'll give you an idea about who most of us think Arthur is and where most of us think he came from. And then we'll kind of unpick that as our starter for 10. We'll talk about what was going on in his time, so generally referred to as the Dark Ages. And then we'll start to pick out where the different versions of him come from, because there are many, many different versions of him from many, many different writers and many different sort of cycles and things like that. So we'll unpick where they all come from. And in that, you'll discover which version you know, because I bet most of you all know slightly different versions of him. Then we will put together the one that I'm certain you don't know, which is how he creeps into the stories of a lot of the Welsh saints. Let's kick off. Let's kick off with who is Arthur. So I'm going to give you a summary. So what follows makes a bit of sense. If you take all the different versions of Arthur and pull them together into some form of holistic view, we think of Arthur as being a 6th century king of the Britons. That's the short answer. He's not always a king. Sometimes he's just a warrior or a general. He's not always from Wales. Sometimes he's from Cornwall. Sometimes he's from France. And you get him from all sorts of different places. So there's a lot of inconsistencies. Sometimes he's a Christian. Sometimes he's a pagan. No one can really make up their minds who he is. But if you pull all this together, he is a 6th century king of the Britons. And where most of our understandings of who he is comes from. I brought 3 books, therefore confusing myself. This book, and this is a book called The History of the Kings of Britain, and this was written by a chap called Geoffrey of Monmouth. And this, when you kind of get a life story of Arthur, this generally is the source that people turn to. So when the people of Tintagel justify having a statue of Arthur at their castle, claiming that that was his birthplace, it's because in this book it says it's his birthplace. And to give you an idea of how reliable this book is as an historical source, I'd just like to read to you one of the extracts from here, which really does give you an idea of the sort of person that we're dealing with here. So this chap, Geoffrey of Monmouth, he was a monk of the Benedictine order, and he, on all of the stories that we get of Arthur, all of the original stories, they were all written by monks. And monks in the medieval period, they were the most educated people about. So to get an education, you had to be a monk or at least spend time in a monastery. But also, they were answering all the big questions of the age. So all of the really big questions, the global questions, they were all answered by the Bible. So why are we all here? What's it all about? What happens when we die? That's all in there. But when it came to more localized stuff, like how did the Bristol Channel get formed, or why is Arari so high? I mean, all of these questions needed answering, but they were still being answered by the church. Monks were providing us with the answers. And because the monks claimed that they weren't actually doing the writing, they were just the vessels, all of the words they were writing down were coming to them from God, that meant that no one could really question what they were writing, which in a way is good, because it meant they could let their imaginations run riot and they could write any old rubbish, and no one was able to say, oh, that sounds a bit far-fetched, are you sure that's real? They could always say, this is the word of God. And that's the end of that argument. So this history of the kings of Britain, this is probably not a reliable historical source, though it was accepted as one for 500 years. And this is an extract from the life of King Arthur from this book that purports to be a history book. And this is from a chapter called Arthur Kills a Spanish Giant Who Had Stolen Away Helena, the Niece of Hoyle. In the meantime, Arthur had news brought to him that a giant of monstrous size was come to the shores of Spain and had forcibly taken away Helena, the niece of Duke Hoyle, from her guard and fled with her to the top of that which is now called Michael's Mount. And the soldier of the country who pursued him were able to do nothing against him, for whether they attacked him by sea or land, he overturned their ships and cast rocks and killed them with several sorts of darts, besides many of them that he took and devoured half alive. So I think that section gives you an idea of how reliable the history in this book is. Let me give you a shocker. Thomas Cromwell cited this book as the legal precedent for the Church of England to separate itself from Rome. So it had some interesting consequences, this book, but it isn't as what you might say a great historical source. But this is where the majority of our Arthur stuff comes from. And then you think about, well, we know something about him. We know who he is. What is a typical Arthur story? And for that, I'm going to give you a little quote from the Mabinogion. So the Mabinogion, for those who are not familiar with it, this is essentially a catalogue of all of the greatest old myths, legends and stories that the bards would take with them when they travelled around the lands to entertain the gentry. And a lot of the traditions that we have from Arthur come from this period. So we're not absolutely certain when this was written. It certainly wasn't all written by one person. This is a collection of works that were published by lots of people, mainly in the 13th century, but some of the stories, I mean, they go back into the sands of time. So this is from a story called How Collwch Won Olwen, which is an interesting take on a romantic story. The general plot is Collwch wishes to win Olwen as his wife. He goes to her father, and her father, as is quite predictable with medieval stories, sets him a series of tasks that he needs to complete in order to win her hand. So because these tasks are quite difficult, he recruits his cousin Arthur to help him perform these tasks, and they get about halfway through the tasks when they just give up and just decide to kill her father, and so he can marry her anyway. So I think the moral of this story is, if at first you don't succeed, kill everyone who knows you tried. So this is a fairly typical Arthur. So this is Arthur doing all the things that Arthur normally does. So Arthur said, "Are there any of the wonders we have still not obtained?" And one of the men said, "Yes, the blood of the very black witch, daughter of the very white witch, from Penant Govid in the uplands of hell." That's just outside. Arthur set out for the north and came to... I'll change some of the language in this because it's not very PC. Arthur set out from the north and came to where the old lady's cave was. And Gwyn, son of Nedd, and Gwythwr, son of Greidiol, advised that Cacamwyr and Higwydd, his brother, should be sent to fight the old woman. As they came into the cave, she attacked them. She grabbed Higwydd by the hair and threw him to the ground beneath her. Cacamwyr grabbed her by the hair and pulled her off Higwydd to the ground, and she turned on Cacamwyr and thrashed both of them and disarmed them and sent them out, shrieking and shouting. Shouting. I got through the really hard words and then struggled with shouting. Arthur became angry at seeing his two servants almost killed and tried to rush at the cave. And then Gwyn and Gwythyr said to him, "It's not proper, and we do not like to see you wrestling with a lady. Let Hir Amren and Hir Eddoeth into the cave." And they went. But if the first two had difficulty, the fate of these two was far worse. So that God knows how any of the four could have left the place had it not been for the way they were all pulled out by Llamriae, Arthur's mare. And then Arthur rushed to the entrance of the cave, and from the entrance he aimed at the old woman with Carwenan, his knife, and struck her in the middle, so she was cut in twain. And good pantomime crowd in tonight. And Cow of Pridin took the witch's blood and kept it with him. Now, there's lots of things in here that are typical Arthur. So first of all, it's a witch at the end of the day, but a lady. So somehow there's an opportunity for some chivalry. So initially, because it is somebody of the female sex, Arthur is reluctant, despite the fact that she's already virtually killed four of his men. He's reluctant to take her on because it's not chivalrous. So his initial thoughts, shall I charge? Oh, no, best not. Best stand back. It's typical, typical Arthur. Arthur is always carrying this sort of chivalrous image around with himself. Secondly, he is fighting against evil. That is, again, something you generally find Arthur doing, is somebody who's been very, very nasty indeed, is always at the butt end of Arthur's wrath. And then finally, when he does act, he acts very decisively and with great skill. All it takes is one throw of his knife and the enemy is vanquished because he is so accurate and so pinpoint. So we've got all the elements of a fairly typical Arthur story in here. Now, we're going to discover tonight that that's not always how Arthur is presented. It may be something that sounds quite familiar to us, but there are many, many sides to Arthur. So let's have a look at his time, because he is a man of his time, and his time gives away why we've got so much grey area about him, who he was, and what he did. So the period that we're looking at here, 5th and 6th century, and sort of into the 7th as well, in this period of history, according to the history books, most of Britain is pagan. There are some small pockets of Christianity. Some of them people descended from Roman families, Roman occupiers from a couple of centuries earlier. And also on our doorstep, I spoke about it before. I'll speak about it again in a minute. Llantwit Major, Llanisid Fawr, that was established around about 508. So, you know, we had some really early outliers of Christian mission here in South Wales. Another thing that was happening was the arrival of various Germanic hordes. So the Jutes, the Angles and the Saxons were all here in the UK, not so far west as here. They generally speaking ended at the old Kingdom of Wessex. I'm sure a couple might have wandered along, but not generally speaking. This is part of the narrative of what's going on in Arthur's life for most of the story. So most of the stories we hear about Arthur, he is fighting Saxons, and he is the king of the Britons who manages to hold off the Germanic hordes. So he's a great hero of his time. But the problem with all of this is not very much is being written down in this period of history. And that's why it's called the Dark Ages. And what is being written down, not a lot of it has survived. Interestingly, one that has survived is this book here. Now, I was reading this earlier. The general thrust of this book is that Britain as a nation is on its knees. Everything seems to be going wrong. The young don't respect the elders anymore. People have sort of not gone to church anymore. And the biggest problem we face is all the foreigners. So this could be this morning's Daily Mail, to be honest with you. But no, this was written 1,500 years ago by St. Gildas the Wise, who was a monk based in Llancarvan. He was a disciple of St. Cadoc. And Gildas the Wise will crop up a bit later on because he does have a connection.
Pro Radio.
The summer holidays are fast approaching. And if you're looking for great ways to keep the whole family entertained, we've got you covered at Fonmon Castle. As well as an immersive film weekend, we've special themed weekends too, like pirates and fairies, K-pop, ice princess and superheroes at the castle. You can encounter dinosaurs in Jurassic Wales. Follow the Welsh folklore story trail. And don't forget, until the summer holidays arrive, we're open every weekend from 10 till 4. Book tickets at fonmoncastle.com.
Glastonbury, the Vale's big live tribute festival, is back for 2026. With 22 amazing tribute acts performing across one massive weekend. With tributes to Pink, Foo Fighters, Tom Jones and Steps on the Saturday, and Coldplay, ABBA, Tina Turner and Queen on the Sunday. Check full listings online. Glastonbury 2026, in association with Synergy Scaffolding. Live at Romilly Park on Saturday the 25th and Sunday the 26th of July. Sponsored by forklift specialist Gary Watson Motor Co., CJCH Solicitors and Joe Ferriday Aesthetics. Book tickets now at glastonbury.com.
Make this summer the season your child dives into confidence. Introducing intensive swim courses across the Vale and at Cardiff International Pool. For just £15, your child gets a full week of focus. These sessions run for 25 minutes once a day, helping improve water confidence, develop essential skills, and allow for extra practice. It's the fast track to fun and safety in the water for the summer holidays. Spaces are limited, so book your intensive swim course now at leisurecentre.com.
Gildas the Wise is writing about events we associate with Arthur at the time they were happening. So one of the things he writes about in here is the Battle of Badon. And Badon Hill is one of those battles that, generally speaking, certainly Geoffrey of Monmouth has attributed to Arthur, that Arthur was the person who was at that battle. He won it and he won the victory for the Britons. So this guy writes a very full and thorough account of the Battle of Badon. He does so within 50 years of the battle actually happening. And at no point anywhere in this book does he mention Arthur. Arthur is not even making the tea. He's not even helping out on the sidelines. He is not mentioned. The person who he says is commanding the British troops in that battle is a chap called Ambrosius Aurelius. And a lot of people say, well, oh gosh, then that maybe that's Arthur under a different name. But even the ever reliable Geoffrey of Monmouth cast doubt on his own story, because he says that Aurelius is at the coronation of Arthur. So he's using this book as a source, but is completely contradicting what it has to say. So do you see where we start to get the confusion? Do you see where everything starts to fall apart? So all of the stuff that we have about Arthur really comes from several hundred years after he died. The earliest sort of comprehensive one is the Geoffrey of Monmouth one, which comes to us in the 12th century, written round about 1136. But all the other ones that come after that come in successive centuries, and they all add their own layer. So that's what's sort of going on. I mentioned briefly about Llanllyfrid Fawr earlier. Llanllyfrid Fawr is very relevant to what we're going to be talking about tonight, because this place, for those who are unaware, this place turned out saints like a factory, okay? So you name a decent saint from the 6th century from Northern Europe, the chances are they are educated here. You can go there to study the scriptures, also mathematics, Latin, science, philosophy, art. So this is definitely more than a monastery. This is an institution for education. This is the earliest record that we have of a school of any kind in anywhere in Britain. And really, the standard of instruction that people are getting at this place is university level. So that means that this place is a melting pot of ideas, of art, of culture, of storytelling. And I think that this place has got quite a big part to play in the evolution of Arthur. And when you look at where we get our Arthur stories from, they're generally from Ireland, England, Cornwall, Wales, and Brittany. And that's where the output from this place both came from and went to. And it's the right time period. So I believe that people came, because we know generally with bardic storytelling, what you do, as I illustrated earlier with the Mabinogion, you have a stock of stories that you take wherever you go. And then when you tell those stories, you change the name of the central character to somebody that everybody in your audience knows. You change the name of the place where the adventure is set to a place that everybody knows. And then when you tell that story somewhere else, you change it again. So what I'm pretty confident is happening, because it's for me too much of a coincidence, is you've got intellectuals arriving at a university, the only one of its kind in Northern Europe. They are, yes, learning about the scriptures, but they are also telling each other stories. And there are favourite characters that come out of these stories, and I believe Arthur was one of those favoured characters, that whenever you're telling a great story about a warrior or a general, that this is the name that you give them. Now, that's not me saying I'm therefore convinced he never existed, because it is impossible to prove that either way. And I'm always very suspicious of people. You quite often see on social media, somebody's got a book coming out and they say, finally, I am able to prove I have the evidence. I know the truth about Arthur. Absolute nonsense. No, you don't. You may have a little bit of extra evidence, but what you don't have is decisive evidence that would back up a claim. So that is where I think all of this comes from. And what I also am about to demonstrate to you is in the 12th and the 13th century, when the medieval monks are writing up the stories of the saints who came out of this institution, they had made that connection as well. Because in most of their stories, there is something to do with Arthur. Even if it's just a throwaway, there is something to do with Arthur in all of them. Where do we get our stories from? Well, I've given you some of them already. So here's our evolution. This is the beginning of things that we can point to and say, that's the earliest references that we have. So the starting point is somewhere in the 6th century, there has to be somebody somewhere called Arthur, or any of the names that Arthur is derived from. Arthuras, Arthruis, Arturos. They're all part of the same thing. The weird thing is, this is not a common name. I've heard lots of people on TV programmes saying, oh, there were hundreds of people wandering around Wales called Arthur. There genuinely weren't. It's very unusual for this period in history. Came popular later, but that's because of these stories. There is a contender, okay, so we do have somebody who was called Arthrus ap Moerig, who was a king of Gwent. He's called Arthur, so he's a good start, and he's a king, and he's in the right century. So there are a lot of people who say, oh, maybe it's him, maybe that's who it's all based on. But the thing is, he's 50 years too late. So even though he's 6th century, he's too late in the 6th century, so he comes after all the battles and things that we attribute to Arthur having fought in. His court was in Caerleon, which is where Geoffrey of Monmouth says that Arthur's court was, so we've got some symmetry, but the guy wasn't a warrior. He was a little weedy, weak king. He was the antithesis of everything that Arthur stands for, so there is absolutely no way that it's based on him. Maybe the name, maybe he thought, oh, I've got a great hero in mind, I need a good name. Oh, let's name it after this. I don't know. That's a possibility. But yeah, Arthur is not a common name. And I know the thing that how close it is to the Welsh word for bear, and that's quite often cited as being... I mean, those two things could be connected, but it just doesn't make it a common name in Wales. Believe it or not, it's a bit more common in Ireland. So there is a good possibility, and a lot of people who came to Llantwit Major came from Ireland. So there is a possibility that that's where the name came to us from. But what we haven't got is anyone really easy to point to and say, oh, it was clearly him. In terms of references, we've got lots of stories about him in the bardic tradition. I mean, I gave you a blast of one earlier with Coluch and Olwen, and we can't date that. Nobody has a clue when that was written. You've got stories, songs and poems, but you can't date. Because it's impossible to say, well, when do people start telling this poem? It's not as people write things down that we can start dating things. And the earliest datable reference that we've got to Arthur is from the late 6th century. So it's quite kind of contemporary. And it's a poem called Y Gododdin. And it was written by another monk, funny enough, called Y Noerin, or we believe it was. It's from a work called The Book of Y Noerin, so we assume Y Noerin wrote it. And to be honest, the reference to Arthur in Y Gododdin is fleeting. So the poem is about an absolutely disastrous war that is being fought between the kingdom of Gwynedd and the kingdom of Northumberland. And it's quite interesting. When you look at accounts of this war, both sides claim to be the Christians fighting against the pagans. And of course, it's both nonsense. It's just propaganda. Both sides in this conflict were Christians. In fact, the king of Northumberland was a saint himself. So there's absolutely no question that they weren't pagans. However, in Gododdin, it's a very visceral as well, kind of account of battles and warfare and hand-to-hand combat. And there is a reference to a warrior. And this is how simplistic and throwaway this is. The reference of the warrior is he was a great warrior, skilled in warfare, but he was no Arthur. And that was it. That's all it says. But the fact that it says, but he was no Arthur, certainly gives the impression that in that time, that means the name was sufficiently well known for that fleeting reference to be enough for everyone to go, oh, right. Oh, so he was decent, but not quite that good. And that's the first reference, the first datable historical reference we've got to him. And it's quite a broad one, isn't it? I mean, it really leaves everything wide open. But what it clearly demonstrates is the name is in the psyche at this point. It, then the next time we get a version of him is the Historia Brittonum, written by Nennius, another monk. This written around 828. And the Historia Brittonum, even though it has the word Historia in it, is about as reliable as this for history. So it's basically, it's a sermon. It's a religious exercise. And everything in it gets lots of details wrong. So, for example, it says that Arthur fought at the Battle of Badon Hill, and it also says that he fought at the Battle of Chester. Well, those two battles are 100 years apart. So that didn't happen. And they also claim that at the Battle of Badon, that he went into battle with a shield with the Virgin Mary on the front of it, and he held aloft the cross of our Lord for 7 days. So it's all really, really religious, and it's all about how Gwynedd is the only godly place in the country, and everywhere else has gone to the dogs. About as optimistic as Gildas was. So You've got a lot of references to Arthur in this story, even though, again, we know the story is clearly bunkum because so much historical stuff is just, they've just got the details wrong. But what you do have as a result of this story is Arthur becoming a crusader, Arthur becoming somebody who's associated with godliness and virtue. So he's starting to take on arms and legs that we might recognise now. Then we come, of course, to good old Geoffrey of Monmouth. And what Geoffrey of Monmouth did was, frankly, just made up a life story, because there was no biography of Arthur. There was no Arthur when he was in the early days, and there was no Arthur when he was an old man. There were just stories like the one I read you earlier when he was attacking the witch, where he just crops up, does something tremendously heroic, and then disappears. A bit like Clint Eastwood in the spaghetti westerns. So he was that sort of a character. He didn't have a beginning and an end. He was just there when you needed him. But what Geoffrey of Monmouth did was he gave him a biography and said, oh, right, well, he was born in Tintagel. I mean, no previous reference to that anywhere. He did that himself. We know there was a very high status group of people living in Tintagel in the 6th century. Undoubtedly, people in the 12th century were aware of that. So he just put two and two together and made 28. So he gives us the first version of Arthur. Arthur's still not fully formed. He's got a life story. He gets buried in Avalon, which comes back to bite everyone in the bottom several times. But he's not fully rounded yet. He's still got a bit of work to go. Then the French get hold of him. And sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but they did a much better job. The French stories are definitely the best stories. And they are the ones that when you watch films about Arthur, generally speaking, it's the French version that you're watching. So Chrétien de Troyes, he was a romantic poet, and he sunk his claws into Arthur. And the reason why the French, by the way, were so enamoured with Arthur is because Geoffrey of Monmouth had chosen to bury him in Avalon. And Avalon isn't in Glastonbury, as people in Glastonbury will tell you. It's in France. It's in Burgundy. So when Geoffrey of Monmouth buried Arthur in Avalon, Henry I was just so happy because he just poured a massive part of his personal fortune into building the abbey at Vesle. And now he'd given them a relic that everyone would want to visit on pilgrimage. So Geoffrey of Monmouth's sighting of Avalon really, really helped the French out massively. So they loved him. They thought he's fantastic. Now, I know we try to take him back because, as is always the case, the political tide changes. So as much as Henry I had invested a fortune in building the abbey at Vesle, Richard the Lionheart, at the same abbey, swore a very embarrassing pledge to the King of France, which he subsequently wanted to step back from. We don't know, but if I was the King of France and the King of England was pledging something to me and I thought I had the remains of Arthur in my abbey, I would make him swear it on the remains of Arthur. So this possibly pays into why Richard the Lionheart was so keen to move Arthur out of France. And because the skint monks in Glastonbury had just paid to have their monastery rebuilt after it had burnt down, and they claimed to have found the remains of Arthur in the grounds of the new abbey, he could not move quick enough to get this story verified, and he dispatched Gerald of Wales down there not once but twice to say that he'd seen the remains of Arthur, and it's definitely true, he's in Glastonbury. So a lot has gone on there, but in the meantime, of course, the French have already fallen in love with this man, with Arthur and the character. Chrétien de Troyes starts to make him a more chivalrous character. He also came up with the first concept of a grail. So there's a story of Sir Percival. Well, we're not sure if it was de Troyes who wrote this. It comes from the Vulgate series, and we don't know for certain who wrote it, but it does sort of have his fingerprints over it, where Sir Percival saw a parade that included a grail. It's not yet a holy relic, it's just an item, but a seed has been sown. Robert de Boron, he was the one who really got to grips with the grail, and he embellished the stories to give us, well, characters that Troyes had come up with, like Sir Lancelot and Sir Bedivere and Sir Galahad. These were all cooked up between these two French poets. And the whole story of Sir Lancelot and Guinevere, that's all from the French version. So all the version that we generally know, where there's a Holy Grail and there's a Lancelot and there's a Guinevere, these are all from the later French versions, unfortunately.
Bro Radio.
A cup of tea, a friendly chat, a helping hand when it's needed most.
That's what Churchfields Home Care is all about. We provide professional home care, companionship, dementia support and personal care across the Vale of Glamorgan. And now we're looking for new, caring people to join our growing team. If you're seeking a new, rewarding career, apply today at churchfieldshomecare.co.uk. Churchfields Home Care, because the little things make the biggest difference.
Are you a small business owner or an entrepreneur? TL Systems are specialists in supporting sole traders and small businesses with their IT and telephone needs. We'll supply your internet, phone, office, security and web hosting, and then back it all up so your data is safe. Our rates are very affordable for you as a small business owner. We can supply everything and give you peace of mind with a maintenance contract from as little as £30 per month. TL Systems. Call us for a chat on 01446 747 702. Pop into our shop at the bottom of Halton Road, Barry, or visit tlsystems.co.uk.
If you want pet supplies delivered free to your door or dream of having a beautiful garden, then Uno's Pet and Garden Store in Llanfit Major is the name to know. From poultry to puppies, horses to hamsters, whatever the pet, we have what you need, including food, treats and treatments. We also stock all your garden essentials, so whether you're a green-fingered expert or a less prolific planter, we have everything you need for your perfect garden and offer free delivery to the majority of the Vale with no minimum order. Visit us online now at unospetstore.com. That's unospetstore.com.
Thomas Malory brought it home in 1485. Can be all very proud of him. So he wrote The Morte d'Arthur, which again is a very romanticised tale of what Arthur was about. But by the time we get to this Arthur, we are a very long way removed from the one I was telling you about earlier. The one who can cut a witch in half by throwing a dagger. Yeah, we've moved on. This chap is very high status. He's quite godly. He's sort of removed from humanity. He's almost immortal. In fact, he is immortal because in the Malory version of his story, he doesn't die. He just goes to sleep in a cave surrounded by all of his warriors. And if the nation is ever in peril, then they will wake up and rise up and defend the nation. So yeah, he's actually made him immortal. When you think about it. So it has gone way beyond the warrior that we used to have. So how does that all feed in to the Welsh saints? Well, most of the stories of the Welsh saints were written in the sort of the 12th and the 13th century. And that's when the Normans established the great monasteries of places like Margam and Neath. And they'd sort of repurposed Llanfit Major and Llancarvan and all of these monasteries. And these people are writing their local history. They are all very much aware of the saints who came from this area. They are aware that these saints are generally 6th century. And they are aware that that is a century that you associate with Arthur. So Arthur creeps into an awful lot of their stories. But the Arthur in these stories is nothing like any of the Arthurs that we've just seen. The Arthur in these stories tends to be a bit dark and sinister. He tends to be pagan, not Christian. He tends to be impulsive and petulant, violent and trigger happy. You'll see him portrayed as a murderer and a thief and a swindler, which is a very, very long way from Robert de Boron's character who can't die, isn't it? We've gone down a very, very different path. But there are loads of them. And when you start scratching the surface, they start falling out at you. Here's an example. So St. Illtyd, for example. We know St. Illtyd was the man who founded Llanilltyd Fawr in Llanfit Major. We also know, if we're absolutely honest, that he would have been before Arthur, because Arthur would have to have lived to be about 70, 80 years old to have fought in the Battle of Badon if he was around at the time of St. Illtyd. But we have got, in the life of Illtyd, one of the versions written in the 13th century, a claim that Illtyd was one of Arthur's warriors. So the version of this story that we have is that Illtyd was the son of a Breton prince. He was not interested in becoming a man of the church. His main love was sitting in the saddle of a horse with a sword in his hand. That's what he wanted to be doing. And he took a wife and they had children, and when he wasn't at home being a pain in the backside, he was out fighting wars, and he was recruited by Arthur to come and fight in his team against the Saxons. And that Ithdid was at Baden, which he can't possibly have been because he'd have been like 130 or something. So he was at Baden and he fought alongside him. And when he was in Baden, this is when he first discovered Wales and came here and found what he believed to be the perfect spot for an institution that he could dedicate to St. Germanus of Auxerre, and that's why he chose Llantwit Major as the place for his monastery. Now, I've been saying all the way through this cannot possibly be true. The numbers just don't add up. However, we're kicking off with an example of a story that was put about in the 13th century that Arthur is part of Ithdid's story, which kind of goes back to what I was saying about why I think the institution at Llantwit Major is where all these stories originate from. We've got another great one. So we've got stories of Arthur in St. Cadoc's story. So in St. Cadoc's story, there's two versions. There's one that Cadoc had three men in his charge, and a rather impetuous and violent Arthur just came along and killed them. And Cadoc, of course, was absolutely furious with him, and he tore a strip off him. And Arthur kind of bowed down and apologised and said he was really sorry. He doesn't know what came over him. He's not normally like this. He thinks he's got undiagnosed ADHD. All of these excuses came out. I made that last bit up. Strike that. That's not going out on the radio. I'll edit that up. So Arthur agrees that he will pay homage to Cadoc, and he will do what Cadoc bids him in order to repair the damage that he's done. So in this story, Arthur is a murdering thug, which is quite interesting. So there are two stories that come out of it. The first is the sacks of grain. So what Cadoc does to make Arthur pay for a reparation is there is a small village which has been cut off by a flood. The river has swollen and they're unable to get out. So what he makes Arthur do is carry sacks of grain across the river to give to the people of this village so they will have something to eat. Which isn't very Arthur-y, is it? When you think about it, go back to the story of the witch he cut in half. So Arthur in this story is servient. Arthur in this story is a murdering, impetuous thug who, when it comes down to it, has a strip torn off him by a saint, and he is totally servient to this saint. He does whatever the saint's bidding is, even something as humiliating for somebody who is either a general or a king, which is not clear in this particular version, carrying grain across to feed the poor, something quite humble, something you would ask a servant to do. So already we've got Arthur, a very, very different Arthur, coming out of a saint story. The reason, more than likely, is the story is trying to illustrate how powerful and mighty the saint is by virtue of the fact that he's a saint. So even a worldly king, somebody with all the trappings of wealth and power that a mortal man can expect to wield, even he has to bow down and do the bidding that the saint asks him to do. So that's clearly what's coming out of this. There's another story, because having got the grain across to the village, Cadoc isn't satisfied. He still needs to pull his weight to make up for these people he murdered. So there's another story where he is asked to pay a ransom for a set amount, and Arthur asks, "Can I pay this amount in cattle rather than in cash?" And Cadoc says, "Yes, of course, more than happy. The exchange rate is very favourable at the moment. More than happy to accept cattle." In this instance, Arthur tries to outsmart Cadoc, and Arthur gets sacks of corn, of fern even, gets these sacks of fern, and he gets them stitched together so that they look like cattle. And then he puts them amongst real cattle so that from a distance it looks like a huge herd of cattle. And he thinks, "Oh, I've got him here. I've pulled a fast one here. He's never going to know." And by the time he realises what's happened, I'll be long gone. But of course, the great saint is not so easily tricked. And he realises what is happening. So with a sweep of his hand, a miracle, and all these sacks just disintegrate and turn back into piles of ferns. So Arthur's is exposed for what he's trying to do. So again,
Arthur is a swindler. He's a murderer and a swindler, and he tries to get one over, a con artist. That what? Where did this Arthur come from? And this isn't the only example. So I've mentioned Gildas a few times. The most significant thing about Gildas is how he makes no mention of Arthur anywhere. However, the people who wrote Gildas's story in the medieval period used Gildas quite a lot. So, for example, his brother Hywel was killed by Arthur. That's part of the story of St. Gildas, that Hywel and Arthur got into a dispute, and Arthur cut his head off. And if you go to Conwy, there is actually a memorial stone just outside the castle saying that this is the spot where Arthur had beheaded Hywel. So some people argue the reason why Gildas never mentioned Arthur in the ruin of Britain is because he was having beef with Arthur for killing his brother. And it was, well, I'm not going to mention in my book then. I think it's people have genuinely claimed that. Well, that might be true, who knows? But that's not the only thing, the only connection. So there's another connection. And the connection is that Gildas's sister, who is St. Gwyllog, she was married to Mordred. And Mordred is supposedly Arthur's cousin. And it's also Mordred is the person who betrayed Arthur at the Battle of Camlann, resulting in him losing the battle and being killed. So the monks in the sort of 11th, 12th and 13th century who are writing up the lives of the 6th century Welsh saints are always dropping Arthur in, are always including him. But the version of Arthur that they use is completely unrecognisable for every other version that we get. And it goes on. So this is St. Kerannog. And he's got, so to be fair, this one, Arthur is a bit more, he behaves more the way you would expect him to based on his other stories. So in the story of St. Kerannog, he has a portable altar, which, let's be fair, does sound like a folding table. But I think what we're talking about here is a slab of stone that they would carry around with them and they would use to so they could give prayers and mass wherever they happen to be. So he loses this, which is careless, isn't it? So he loses this altar. Apparently it just flies away. So he goes travelling throughout the world in search of it. And the story is generally about the different peoples he encounters on his searches. And on his search, he encounters Arthur. And Arthur is fighting a dragon. So he goes up to Arthur and says, "That looks difficult. Do you want a hand?" And Arthur says, "Yeah, okay. This is hard, I'll be honest with you." So Kerannog casts a spell over the dragon and absolutely subdues it. And Arthur is so grateful that he says, "Thanks ever so much for the dragon thing. Are you looking for an altar by any chance?" And St. Kerannog said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, let me help you then." So Arthur then goes on the journey with St. Kerannog to help him find the altar. And apparently he becomes so enamoured with Kerannog and his holiness and his piousness that he decides to give away most of his kingdom to the poor because Kerannog has influenced him so much. And there's a widely held belief, and this could be true. Generally speaking, when you look at heraldic symbols for Arthur, the dragon is usually one of them. And that, of course, is the origins of our national symbol. That's where that comes from. And it's certainly why Henry Tudor used it. So that's probably the beginnings of the dragon motif in his heraldic symbol, is that particular story. That's not the last of it. So St. Dubric. St. Dubric is also known as St. Dubricus. He's known by both names. He was the first bishop of Llandaff, and his tomb is in Llandaff Cathedral. If you haven't seen it, you've got to go, because it was, obviously, even though he's 6th century, the tomb was created in the 13th century when de Clare was around and had the money to pay for all these exotic things. So they made this tomb for him in the 13th century. And at the top of the tomb is a little figure that is meant to be Jesus looking down at Dubric. And clearly the person they got to engrave this was too embarrassed to say, "What does Jesus look like exactly?" Because if you look at this little engraving, he's just carved a typical sort of 13th century Welsh noble. So he doesn't look at all Jesus-like. There's none of the usual things that you expect to see. No long hair or beard or crown of thorns. He's just a medieval bloke looking down at Dubric from a little window at the top of his tomb. Glorious stuff. But I can give you the stuff about Dubric from dear old Geoffrey of Monmouth, because he gives us a very, very thorough account of the coronation of King Arthur.
When all were assembled together in the city, when he says the city, he means the city of legions, which is Caedleon. When all were assembled together in the city upon the day of the solemnity, the archbishops were conducted to the palace in order to place the crown upon the king's head. Therefore, Dubricus, inasmuch as the court was kept in his diocese, made himself ready to celebrate the office and undertook the ordering of whatever related to it. As soon as the king was invested with his royal habiliments, he was conducted in great pomp to the metropolitan church, which was Llandaff. So Geoffrey of Monmouth gives us the version of St. Dovrig's story, where he's the man who's actually responsible for crowning Arthur. So that's a bit more typical. Here's another one, which is just plain weird. So St. Paddon has a miraculous cloak. Oh, I'd love to have a miraculous cloak. I know Harry Potter's got one, but St. Paddon had one first. St. Paddon has a miraculous cloak. Arthur sees it, covets it, and steals it. The moment he puts it on, it burns him. It starts to burn his skin, so he can't bear it against him. So he tries to take it off because it's burning him, but he can't take it off. It is burnt. It's like napalm. It is sticking to him, and it is burning. He eventually falls to his knees, and he repents to the saint and begs for forgiveness, which of course Paddon agrees to do in return for honour and gifts to the poor, and his cloak is returned to him. So we've had Arthur as a trigger happy sinister murderer, we've had him as a con merchant, now we have him as a thief. So yeah, when it comes to telling the stories of the saints, he doesn't come out well, does he? And he's even in one of the St. David stories, not all of them, but there is a version of St. David's story where he is actually related to Arthur. So again, Geoffrey of Monmouth tells us that Arthur's father is Uther Pendragon, and that Arthur becomes king when Uther Pendragon is poisoned. The well that he drinks from is poisoned by those wicked Saxons, and that is the trigger for Arthur to be king. There's a different version of Arthur's story where Arthur is an orphan. So this version comes from St. Caradog of Llancarvan, and King Arthur is raised by King Caredig ab Cynedda of Ceredigion, who, of course, is the natural father of St. Non, who is the mother of St. David. So in the St. Caradog of Llancarvan version of Arthur's story, he is St. David's adopted uncle. So he even creeps into St. David's story. So it's a bit mad, isn't it? So we've got lots and lots of different versions of Arthur. I mean, I started off by telling you the versions that we know, by the versions that are familiar, the romantic stories with Guinevere and Lancelot, and the stories of battle hardiness and winning at the Battle of Badon, and where all those different things came from. And then we came to the versions of Arthur where he comes into the stories of the saints that he was contemporary with, where he's a very different one. St. Itlid, he's one of Arthur's warriors. St. Cadoc, Arthur kills one of his men and must play compensation, and then tries to kid St. Cadoc, swindle him. St. Gildas, Arthur kills his brother in a feud. Gildas's sister, St. Gwythlog, married to Mordred, who betrays Arthur. St. Dovrig, or Dubricus, crowned Arthur as king. St. Paddon attempts, he tries to steal his miraculous cloak. St. Caranog recovers his floating altar with Arthur's help. St. David, he's an adopted uncle, and St. Caradog of Llancarvan personally claims to be a descendant of Arthur. So you've got all of this symmetry, and none of it adds up. If anything, it makes the whole thing more confusing. So thank you very much for indulging me tonight.
You gotta help me, I'm losing my mind. Keep getting the feeling you wanna leave this all behind. Thought we were going strong, I thought we were holding on, aren't we? No, they don't teach ya this in school. Now my heart's breaking and I don't know what to do. Thought we were going strong, thought we were holding on, aren't we? we were going strong. Thought we were holding on, aren't we?
Llanylldyd Fawr. Byddem wrth ein bodd pe bai'ch yn ymuno â ni ar y trydydd dyddiau o bob mis. Cewch gwrdd â grwpiau cymunedol a sefydliadau lleol wrth iddynt ymgynnull yng nghanolfan CF61. Mae cyngor a chefnogaeth am ddim. Gallwch gwrdd â phreswylwyr eraill dros baned braf o de. Ac mae cyfle I gael awyr iach yng ngerddi hyfryd CF61. Ewch i'r ganolfan bwyd a mwy yn Llanylldyd Fawr rhwng hanner ar wedi 12 a hanner ar wedi 2 ar y trydydd dyddiau o bob mis yng nghanolfan CF61 ar heol yr orsaf.
For quality car parts at low prices, head to LMF Motor Factors on Main Street, Barry. Whatever parts you need, brake pads and batteries, to oil and accessories, our experienced team will find what you need. LMF Motor Factors is an independent company that values the business of our local community, and we're determined to keep the Vale on the road for less. LMF Motor Factors, visit us today on Main Street, Barry. Why go anywhere else?
Memoria Cardiff and Glamorgan invite you to visit their beautiful memorial park on Port Road East. Come and take a look around the peaceful grounds, where they offer both cremation and burial plots designed to provide a lasting place of remembrance. Meet the friendly team who will be on hand to answer any questions and guide you through the options available. Find out more at cardiffandglamorganmemorial.co.uk or call 01446 724042.
On FM,
DAB,
smart speaker
and the Bro Radio app.
This is Bro Radio.